It's the 12th of April, 2024. This is the Room Now podcast. Hi, I'm Dr. Jack Cush, executive editor of RoomNow.com. You may have heard the term. It's the mantra of all of those in academic centers, publish or perish. You know, it's changing. I think it's now no longer publish or perish. I think it's burnout or retire. What? Let me begin with an article that appeared in JAMA this week. And it's really about what happened to nurses recently. This is a cross-sectional study of almost 8,000 nurses in New York and Illinois. And it looked for the top reasons why they left the nursing profession between 2018 and 2021. I think overall the number was somewhere around 2,200, 2,300 who left nursing during that time frame. That's a lot, is it not? And the primary reason for leaving was, one, planned retirement, 39%. Two, burnout, 26%. It's not just the doctors, it's everybody in healthcare. Next, insufficient staffing, 21%, family obligations, 18%, and COVID, 17%. The bottom line on this paper was that a lot of these issues are correctable and addressable by healthcare employers. If you didn't see a blog this week by Catherine Dow, it's called Karoshi. It's a Japanese term that speaks to death by being overworked. And she details her recent experiences and really brings to light a number of the problems that many of us face in rheumatology right now that need to be addressed systematically. And it would fix things like burnout and would fix things like when you plan to retire or when and if you plan to change your job going forward. Again, it's an important time, and these are important issues that we all need to bring to the discussion table. Let's get to the news. A Korean national insurance claim study up to 2018. Look at NSAIDs and the risk of cardiovascular events. This was almost 20,000 patients followed for 98,000 patient years, 1,600 plus cardiovascular events. What they did find that was interesting was those people who increased their NSAID doses in this cohort had an increased risk of a cardiovascular event by 10%, and that was significant. There was an 8% increase in heart failure. There was a 9% increase in stroke. There was a 12% increase in heart failure. The study didn't go into whether these were non-selective non-steroidals or COX-2 specific. I don't think it's going to matter. You know, I was on the FDA advisory panel back in 2003 that took Vioxx off the market, kept Celebrex on the market, took Bextra off the market. And one of the things I learned from that experience was it wasn't so much the particular class of drugs, although the non-selectives were probably somewhat worse, but not all of them. For instance, diclofenac looked a lot worse compared to naproxen for unclear reasons. But to me, after 3 days of testimony and expert analyses, you know, it was minor increase in systolic pressure that led to marginal increase in cardiovascular events. And I think when you look at something like this, 20,000 people taking non-steroidals, these rates seem reasonable to me. And maybe one of the reasons why we shouldn't use non-steroidals. I still believe non-steroidals have a role. I think many of the younger rheumatologists aren't using non-steroidals very much. But I also, and while I would, you know, applaud them for maybe avoiding GI and cardiovascular side effects, I'd ask them, what are you doing about managing pain? Because that's maybe the bigger problem, is it not? Anyway, interesting data from a Korean cohort study. Another study that appeared in Nature, I like this week because it addressed an issue that we don't often talk about. I like to bring up a lot, and that is flare in RA. And they pointed out in this sort of scientific review of the biology that may underlie flares that, number one, joints that are likely to flare are the joints that have previously been affected. That's been a pearl I've been teaching for years. And they attribute this to, they call this joint-specific memory, probably mediated by synovial memory T cells that are taking up residence in the synovium. Most of those are CD8 positive T cells with a restricted T cell receptor repertoire. And the postulate here is that those T cells that are taking up residence, they're memory cells, that they are uniquely responsive to specific antigens, and that those antigen-specific responses drive the T cells and the cascade of events that lead to flare, chemokine and cytokine release. I think it's a nice scenario. I don't think we address the issue of flares. And flares I'm looking at right now and putting into a lecture that I think is going to be a great lecture. And right now, flares are, well, it's a flare and give it steroids. I think it's a lot deeper than that. The consequences of repeated flares are really quite bad, and almost as bad as having sustained high disease activity. So is that not a pearl? Meaning that if someone shows up and they have a flare in a joint, but it's a joint they never had before, would that be a flare of RA, or could that be a concurrent problem? I believe that's a concurrent problem more likely than an RA. If it happens in joints that they've always had problems with, I like to say that it's often the first joint that got involved is often the one that flares, but it's usually ones that have been previously involved. That, I think, is a pearl worth looking at in the future. I put up a few more pearls this week that I think that you might find interesting. Again, I've always marveled the fact that all my fibromyalgia patients have TMJ pain, and that when you squeeze on TMJ and do a good TMJ exam, they get pain there just as much as they will in the supraspinatus and trapezius and, you know, inside the knee, outside the elbow. And much to my surprise, I've been asked to lecture at the maxillofacial surgeon conferences, national conferences, on the topic of fibromyalgia. They believe a lot of this TMJ pain is a myofascial fibromyalgic manifestation. And the point is that if that's a dominant feature, you should be looking at fibromyalgia rather than trying to attribute it to inflammatory or degenerative arthritis. The other pearl I put up was a reminder of something I've talked about before, the 3S rule. The 3S's being a big-time clue that this RA patient may be at higher risk of ILD, especially of the UIP variety, where if you have the 3S's, there's a 13-fold higher rate of UIP in RA patients. That comes from an abstract last year done by Jeff Sparks and colleagues. 3S's are, number one, smoking, number two, seropositivity, and number three, sex, meaning male sex. Smoking, seropositivity, male, 13-fold higher risk of RA-ILD. So I've always been interested in pediatric rheumatology. There's more HSP in pediatric rheum than there is in RA, in adults, I mean. And in kids, there has been a well-known phenomenon of a seasonal predominance here, meaning you seldom see HSP during the hot months, you know, June to August, but September to April are often peak months for the onset of HSP. And this particular study that appeared this week looked at the rates of HSP. Here we go. The rates of HSP and what the infections were that may underlie this. So this was a study of almost 10,000 HSP patients compared to that were pediatric, compared to 75,000 without HSP. They showed that, more importantly, during COVID, so this was done before and during and after COVID, during COVID, the rates of HSP went down 54% with implementation of COVID restrictions, distancing and masking. So in March, by March 2020 and a few months after, down by 54%. But then when they relaxed the COVID rules, it went up plus 37% from its baseline. That was by April of 2021. In a time series analysis, they found that the most common infections were, 60% of them were of the strep species, meaning 37% were strep pneumoniae and 26% were strep pyogenes, and then 17% were rhinovirus. So it does seem clearly that infections are important and that it may be seasonal. And the question is, what are you going to do about it? I mean, are you going to keep kids at home? Are you going to make kids do 6 foot distancing and have them wear masks when they're at school in the school September to April. That's pretty much the whole school year. Is it the school year? Is it being around other kids? Is that how they get all those infections? I guess I want to know what the preventative health measures are. I think this is interesting research, but I don't see a light at the end of the tunnel as to how you're going to affect this outcome. And really, do you want to make public health policies that are going to impact the numbers of HSP, which is rare, really rare. In the grand scheme of things, seen in a primary care doctor's office, in a pediatrician's office, not too common. And even in a rheumatologist's office, not too common. Interesting, but what you're going to do with it? Who knows? What about this data on neuropsychiatric SLE? I was encouraged by this. I love the topic of neuropsychiatric SLE, how it presents, how it gets diagnosed, and what happens to it. And a lot of people really don't have a great insight as to what happens to neuropsychiatric SLE when it happens. This is a study of a retrospective study of 350 neuropsychiatric events. I believe it was at a single center. And they basically showed that if once the neuropsychiatric symptom was attributed to SLE or that the SLE was bad enough that the patient was more likely to be on or initiated on immunosuppressive therapy. And being on immunosuppressive therapy did change the course of the neuropsychiatric symptoms. So being on immunosuppressants, corticosteroids, was associated with more central or focal neuropsychiatric manifestations. If you were treated for those, you were more likely to have resolution. The bottom line is at 12 months, two-thirds or 64% had improvement, although not complete resolution, of their neuropsychiatric manifestations. That tells you something, does it not? Meaning we think of neuropsychiatric disease as being the worst headache ever, a seizure, psychosis, you know, and then you get all kinds of other manifestations. But they don't always respond like bingo when you give them 120 of Solumedrol IV for a week, or you pulse them for 3 days. That there's a lot of patients that will respond, but maybe like only a quarter or 30% that will respond in that hospitalization or first 30 days. The rest may require 12 months. So neuropsychiatric disease is still a big black box. And I think that this sets the bar on what you might expect as far as resolution of symptoms. Let's move on. Another infection study looked at Staph aureus bacteremia and its association with a higher risk of osteo and a bone and joint infections. This is a Danish study of 18,000 patients with Staph aureus bacteremia, 367 of whom had RA, that the risk Staph bacteremia risk in RA was 23%, which is almost double the rate of a non-RA patient. So bacteremia in an RA patient is going to likely land in a joint. It's like our joints are or bone. It's in many ways just like a heart valve. And again, almost a twofold higher risk. And the rates were higher in RA patients who were, one, had joint implants. It was now went up from 23% to 29%. And if you were on a TNF inhibitor, it went up to 42%. And the sad part is, in these patients, mortality rate at 90 days was 35%, one-third. So bacteremia, bad news item if it occurs in RA. A good study done in Ontario by Claire Bombardier, Janet Pope, and colleagues, part of the OBRI, the Ontario Registry on RA patients, looked at the outcomes of nearly 700 RA patients who were either treated with triple DMARD therapy, methotrexate, sulfasalazine, hydroxychloroquine, or double DMARD therapy with methotrexate and leflunomide. I would say a priori, methotrexate leflunomide is going to kill. It's a much better combination. I use it all the time. Don't use so much triple DMARD. Maybe shame on me, because the data in this study showed that, and by the way, in Canada, you're not going to get on a biologic unless you go through these conventional synthetic DMARDs. And that means You got to fail three of them before you go on a biologic. That was been the rule for a long time. So not uncommonly, they go on triple DMARD to meet that requirement right quick, or methotrexate leflunomide to get there quicker. So they use a lot of it in Canada, almost by mandate, and that's different than the way you and I practice. You and I being wherever you are, including if you're in Nepal or Bangladesh or Schenectady. But in this study, triple DMARD therapy stayed on therapy longer, an average of 15 months, compared to those who are on double DMARD, methotrexate leflunomide, only 9.6 months. That was not significant, but was numerically higher. What was significant is that disease activity was significantly better at 6 and 12 months on triple DMARD compared to double DMARD. And that was significant. So before you go around disparaging triple DMARD therapy, you know, you might want to look at this paper and give it another try. I like this study a lot. This is a study about poor health literacy in gout and how it affects outcomes. So they looked at a largely primary care population, 551 patients. And in that population, 30% had two or more flares in 12 months. Overall, they use a survey tool to detect poor health literacy, and that was found in almost 10% of patients. Patients who had poor health literacy had fourfold higher rates of flares, and they were more likely to have oligo and polyarticular flares as well, both of those being significant. The question is, what in the world is health literacy? And it's basically asking your patients, what do you understand of all the information I'm telling you, giving you? Are you getting instructions? Are you following up on them? There are four components of health literacy, and that includes reading and understanding health information, communication and decision-making skills, access to healthcare services, and health knowledge and beliefs. And that's asked in their surveys. You know, we're very good at diagnosing. We're very good at writing a prescription, sending it off to the pharmacy. I'm shocked at the number of people who I send a prescription for, along with two refills to cover them till they come back until their next visit, and they don't refill their medicine because they didn't know. That's clearly health literacy in play and something we really don't pay much attention to. And it could have big time consequences, as is the case shown here in gout. If you may follow on, as I do on Twitter, Dr. Eric Topol, he's got a lot of interesting tweets about journals and articles that he's screening and following, and I like what he does. I think Dr. Topol's out at Scripps, and he put a cool one up this week showing the value of human touch in healthcare. And this was a study, I think it was like 137 studies and I want to say 75,000 patients, and it was a meta-analysis of those studies where the intervention was touch compared to no touch and a wide variety of outcomes. So you all would agree that, you know, mothers who touch their newborns do better than mothers who don't touch their newborns. That data is very, very clear, historic, well-known. But the value of touch in everything from depression to systolic blood pressure to whether you lose weight or not. And that touch, I mean like face-to-face, a doctor who sees you, touches you, talks to you, whatever. But it didn't have to involve actual touch, like being in the room and touching the patient. And his big point on his tweet, and he shows a forest plot where everything's to the right, showing with maybe like 20 different items where touch wins. And is significantly better than non-touch. His point is that, you know, in this day of AI, you know, we may never truly be able to do without touch. Touch still has an important role in the care of our patients. Two more reports, one on neuropsychiatric SLE. I think I already spoke about that. All right, that's good. And then the last one is on ILD and MDA5 autoantibody positivity in patients with dermatomyositis. So you may know that MDA5 is one of the newer autoantibody profiles that are out there. It is associated with a unique and kind of bizarre set of skin disease that's not typically the usual Gottfried's papules and Shawl sign and periungual erythema, but more severe skin manifestations, but more importantly, lung disease. And with a subset of those lung patients having rapidly progressive lung disease in the form of ILD. This particular study of 774 dermatomyositis patients found, this is from the University of Miami, found 1.8% who were MDA5 positive. That was 14 patients, 9 females, mean age 48 years. 8 of the 14 were white. And they found that of their 14 patients, two-thirds of them had that rapidly progressive form of ILD, meaning it comes on in the course of weeks and months with rapid changes and severe dyspnea, and these people have a high risk of death. In their study, again, they wanted to look at how frequently how rapidly these patients will develop these symptoms. So again, 64% had the rapid kind, and 43% met some criteria for rapidly progressive ILD. The time from the MDA5 dermatomyositis diagnosis to the onset of ILD was a mean of 116 days and a median of 163 days. So that's roughly around, 3 to 5 months that happens. So it kind of fits in the scheme of what's been described for rapidly progressive ILD. Interestingly, there was no association between the skin disease, and they had common manifestations like Gottfried's papules and midfacial erythema were the most common ones that they had. But skin disease was not associated with ILD type or this rapidly progressive type. So if you identify people like this, and unfortunately, the ones that I've identified from my practice, I identified them retrospectively after they died, meaning a lot of bad outcomes here. That's it for this week on the podcast. You can go to the website to check out these citations and others. I'll encourage you to look at Dr. Dow's blog from this week on Karoshi. And then next week, you'll be getting an invitation to participate in our Tuesday Night Rheumatology, TNR. This week, we're doing a replay of our vasculitis session at Rheum Now Live 2024. This is a great session. I mean, these speakers all got really, really high marks by the more than 400 people who attended the meeting and registered for the meeting. You get to look at some of their work on Tuesday night. Be there. Catherine Sims from Duke is going to talk about vasculitis and pregnancy. Anisha Dua from Northwestern is going to talk about GPA management. Great lecture. And the great Philip Seo from Hopkins is going to talk about vasculitis, his pearls on vasculitis, and treat to target vasculitis. I don't think you want to miss this. We'll see you next week. Take care.